I'm glad I'm speaking last today because having listened all day to the ideas floating and particularly the educated passion that's in the room, I can feel quite proud of the fact that one of the best things I ever did was to start ACRA. It was born in a fury of frustration. And you don't know the story, in 2002, the Commonwealth and the states were about to renegotiate their five-year deal on funding of hospitals. Traditionally, this has been a argy-bargy fight about dollars. Craig Knowles, who was the health minister in New South Wales at the time, by far the best state health minister I ever worked with, I managed to convince him that this was ridiculous, that we were not talking about reform, only about dollars. And he managed to get his other health ministers to agree. And a task force of 12 or 13 different groups was set up to prepare programs to present at the meeting that the federal government would have with the state government about reform. And people worked their tails off trying to get this. It was a wonderful opportunity. Literally 2 days before the meeting was to be held, Kay Patterson, who was the health minister at the time, pulled the plug on it and said, "This is all too difficult, we're just going to talk about money." A recent survey by the Australian Doctor of GPs asked them who was the worst health minister Australia has ever had, and Peter Dutton got 82% of the vote. They were just too young to have known Kay Patterson, who was clearly the worst health minister I've ever worked with. Anyway, I was so frustrated by this that once the announcement came out, I got on the phone, and by the end of the day, I had 12 organisations, people who'd been involved in the reform process, to set up ACRA. And we had a press conference, and we lambasted the government, and within a few weeks, we had 40 organisations belonging to ACRA. And I'm proud to say, when I see the message from Hunt, when Catherine came today, that I'm very proud of the fact that watching ACRA over the years, wonderful leadership from Tony, and now great to have Jennifer on board. Jim's been a stalwart forever. ACRA is now really respected as a voice speaking collectively for a lot of people that knows what it's talking about and has influence. And that whole concept of setting it up, that it would bring together diverse groups, consumers and professional groups, has turned out to be very, very productive. So I congratulate you all. I'm proud of you. Now, what I want to do is, just in a very few minutes, we're running late, I want to draw together, I think, some of the ideas that we've heard today and give you my ideas, which are not unique by any means anymore. Many of them were actually voiced at our first conference in Old Parliament House in 2003. But an overview of the big picture of what I believe is an evidence-based need for restructure and how we should restructure the healthcare system. For needed structural reform to ever occur, I think there are three essential requirements. And this has been echoed during the day, developing a clear, understandable vision of the future big picture. Selling that vision, and that means selling it to the community first and the politicians second. We've got to make a big effort to have Australians realise there's a better way of doing things. There is frustration out there. We've got to sell that vision. And then we have to have the development of an instrument that can deliver that vision. Our goal, which I think we all agree on, is a system focused on the individual that emphasises prevention, and I've highlighted that because that's clearly one of the Achilles' heels of our health system, that and our total inability to integrate properly in a patient-focused way, that is demonstrably equitable, sustainable, and provides quality care on a timely manner available on the basis of need, not personal or financial well-being. And that latter part, the $29 billion of out-of-pocket expenses that we have to spend on health, has a terrible impact on those people who can't contribute to that $29 billion, just don't have the money to get the help that they need. Catherine King's right. I'm passionate, and many other people are passionate about the fact that the only way to solve the wretched jurisdictional divisions that we have in Australia between the state and federal responsibilities is to set up an Australian Healthcare Reform Commission, an instrument created by COAG, so that this is a committee, a group that would report jointly to the state and federal health ministers. We're never going to get the states to tell the Commonwealth to take over health or vice versa. But this is a possibility. I had a detailed conversation with Catherine King and her chief of staff only 2 weeks ago at Parliament House, and they assured me that they are really interested in setting up a healthcare reform commission. It's nothing new about it. There was one set up by Gough Whitlam in 1975. The terms of reference for that would fit today's scenario perfectly well. It had a lifespan of 6 months because when Fraser got into power, he axed it. And I had a recent chance to talk to the guy who was heading up that reform group. He now works in America. And they were all so excited about the potential of this in 1975. Well, the whole idea is to have a single funder reporting to the COAG Health Council. Pie in the sky, well, as I said, it's been pie in the sky. We've talked about it for 20 years. But Labor continues to promise that it will establish a healthcare reform commission. Hunt continues to say he doesn't see the need for it. I believe it's terribly important, and we got the invitation today that we, and when I say we here, I'm talking about the collective group here, that we need to suggest the terms of reference. It's not good enough just to say, let's have a reform commission. We've got to spell out what that reform commission should do. Now, what should it do? Well, in looking at the big picture stuff, what is the evidence base to suggest? It suggests that the reform commission would establish regional health authorities as one of its first priorities. Obviously, the whole situation of healthcare distribution across borders in Australia and the allocation of resources within state boundaries is just a nonsense. And that those regional authorities would be set up using a resource allocation formula based on area need, not just population basis, what I call geographical adhesiveness, which we certainly don't have in the current system. We would have local health, not hospital networks, formed within these regional health authorities. And then there would be a classic funder-provider split model. We have the regional authorities, the Reform Commission, having a clear vision of the health care they want delivered to the Australian people. We have the money. We have the formula that we want you to administer. Who wants to come on board and provide this model of health care? We'll fund you if you do it well, and we'll be evaluating how you do it. It would fund hospital care and providers of integrated primary care. And the model, I think, undeniably, if you look around the world, the model of primary care that we want to move into, that 11 other OECD countries are far more advanced than we are in delivery, is the medical home model. The whole concept. We just listened to Sharon talking and others. There is no way doctors can do all the sort of things that we need to deliver the healthcare, the primary healthcare that we need. And the whole concept of having people enroll in a program where there's a lot of personal interaction with a team of experienced clinicians whose job it is to help them and their families stay well, rather than our current system where you go to the doctor because you're feeling sick and he might have 20 seconds to give you, so you might be drinking a bit too much sap, and etc. The whole concept of integrated primary care in the medical home model, the whole psychological concepts of associated with people enrolling in a program are all terribly important. There's a worldwide shift to this model. Team medicine, practice team consists of doctors, nurses, and allied health professionals. Interesting, including dental hygienists in America and many other countries. The philosophy of a medical home is that you don't separate oral health from the rest of the health program. And it has to be extended, funded by an extension of the MBS. We pay $7 billion a year to doctors out of the $20 billion we spend on Medicare. It's been estimated we would need to double that to cover the extra professionals that are needed in this program. But if you look at some of the programs like the Kaiser Permanente program in America, where over 10 years they've reduced hospital admissions to their enrolled patients by 42%. Average public hospital admission in Australia costs about $6,000. Average cost of preventing that, each admission, $300. So the economics, the evidence is there for us. And it's imperative then to have team learning for our new group of health professionals to prepare for integrated primary care practice. And that's why I mentioned earlier that I was talking to the Dean of Nursing at Sydney University, who's preparing nurses to work in primary care in this model, and her frustration that they're all telling her, if we can't find jobs, no one will employ us to do this. What do we need from contemporary primary care? This is terribly crucial. We need personalised medicine to try and help prevent illness. Early intervention strategies. Team management of chronic and complex diseases in-house. Is there anything more ridiculous than this primary healthcare network business that's been set up, two for the whole of Tasmania, for example, where a doctor in Hobart who would like to get physiotherapy with Mrs. Jones on Thursday morning has to phone a Launceston to ask the primary healthcare network to help them. A recent survey showed that 67% of GPs have never had any interaction at all with the primary healthcare network. There's only 22 around the whole of Australia. Team management in-house of chronic and complex care because the team's there. And then care in the community for many currently sent to hospital. This is extending out. When I graduated in medicine 53 years or whatever it was ago, it was quite common to have community nurses working closely with GPs. All gone. But the fact that you have a cohort of patients in a practice where they've been continuity of care, they know each other well, and the fragile ones in the community can be cared for from an extension of that medical home is absolutely crucial. There was a trial in Victoria just a couple of years ago where there was a program was funded for community nurses associated with were employed by a practice, and they went out and they looked at people in the home who had atrial fibrillation to make sure they were taking their anticoagulants. They cut in that cohort, they cut hospital admissions and strokes and things by a staggering 40% by that close follow-up of people in the community. Now, the other thing, the other model that is you may not have heard about before, but which is now current in a number of countries, and you can see it in action in New Zealand if you wanted to cross the Tasman. Now, I think this is an absolutely crucial thing. I spent a lot of time speaking to GPs who are intellectually engaged in the concept of medical homes and moving away from fee-for-service, but terrified of what the administrative responsibilities might be in it. And, of course, they know that if you're going to get a contract, you're going to have documentation of the health outcomes you get because of that money you've been paid. And they say, can you imagine that? They're going to monitor all my glycosylated hemoglobins of my diabetics at the end of the year. So what is happening in a number of countries now is this hub-and-spoke model, the better clinical business and quality outcomes. So each local health network has a primary care hub set up. This would be replacing the primary care networks. And the idea is they offer services to affiliated medical homes. So you imagine that you had 20 GP practices turned into medical homes in a geographic area around Sydney or Melbourne or Canberra. And they're doing their job delivering care to patients. But in the centre of that, there is a medical primary care hub that provides them with a whole lot of services that make their job easier. They look after IT, continuing professional development, drug education, measurement of health outcomes, regulatory compliance, payroll, research that can be done by the affiliated practices. And they provide secondary health services, 23-hour wards to reduce ED visits. If you're in Christchurch and you belong to a medical home in Christchurch and you get an attack of asthma, you don't go to hospital, you go to the Copernicus, the primary care hub, where they run 23-hour wards and 80% of patients go home rather than go on to hospital. We've had today people discussing how many people go to emergency departments where really they thought they had a problem and should have been able to be managed in primary care. This concept is how you really get primary healthcare networks or hubs, or what in New Zealand they call primary healthcare organisations, to structure these better reforms. Significant reductions in hospital admissions. We have 600,000 plus avoidable admissions in our system at this moment. Much better end-of-life management in these medical homes. It's discussed with patients and in a timely manner, and the specific expertise to take patients through this is available. And the result of this, as has been shown around the world, is that medical beds now become available for surgery. 75% of patients in public hospitals have medical problems. When I first started working as an intern, it would have been about 50-50 surgery versus medicine. Chronic complex diseases, medical diseases, have taken over public hospitals. The result of that is that surgeons have drifted off to the private sector where they can do their surgery. There's no competition between the private hospital and the public hospital for surgery because there's no reliable bed available for the elective surgical list in a public hospital. By removing so many of the people who don't need to be there who are medical and reinvigorating surgery in public hospitals, you have much more equitable service. You reduce the concern that people have that make them take out private insurance when they really can't afford it, because they now become confident that they will get a timely quality service at a public hospital. So you can phase out taxpayer support. Medical homes improve health literacy. I don't have to tell this audience, there's an abundance of literature showing that as you improve health literacy, people's health improves and their health outcomes and there's less chronic and complex disease. A trial in Newcastle a couple of years ago of after-school program for obese children ran for a year, and it turned out that 80 to 90% of the mothers of those children were obese. At the end of the year, the mothers had lost more weight than the children because they had become educated while they were being told what to do for their children, and they had this far better result. Now, what about selling this sort of vision? I think ACRA can play a major role here. I think it's important for the organisation to continue to broaden its affiliations, and I was delighted to hear that individuals who are passionate about the sort of things that ACRA is passionate about will now be able to join. I think many of the organisations that dropped away from ACRA, ACRA should be approaching them again to join them, because this whole concept of having particularly consumer-orientated organisations part of the deal, I think, is terribly important. I like the idea of the big conversation with Australians that we won't go into now. We might be able to do it later on if we need to. But the whole idea of discussing this sort of model of care with Australians. My experience has been it's a piece of cake. People say, why haven't you done this years ago, when you start talking to them along these lines? And we need to influence politicians before the next election. Now, I think the emphasis, we didn't get a chance to talk about this today very much, but again, from my experience, it's crucial to present to politicians and the public, indeed, the concept of a journey, and also to bring in the experience of other OECD countries. We aren't going to be pioneers in any of the stuff I've been talking about. We need to emphasise the concept of a journey, that you're not going to, you know, if Bill Shorten the other day, when he told the press club he was going to cut out his support for private health insurance, the next day he's lambasted and he's turned around and said, oh, well, just for the first 2 years we'll freeze the rebate. If he had said, over 10 years, Labor plans to reduce that support for private health insurance because we will have built up the capacity of public hospitals, no one could have attacked him. The whole concept of a journey is terribly important. Emphasising cost effectiveness associated with a full range of reforms, and I believe we would still be spending less percent of GDP required, have a much healthier older Australians, and palpable equity. Now, of course, we haven't got time to do, we've been talking, just hearing from Sharon about social determinants of health, tactics for addressing Indigenous and rural inequity, health literacy, critical thinking skills provided in school. There's much more to be done. But I do think a cohesive, evidence-based model for genuine structural reform can be told to the Australian public, and I think there's a major role for ACRA in doing that in the future. Thank you very much for listening to that.